Welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Don Bishop, writing as T.S. Pedramon. And today is October 27th, 2023, as we record this. That's correct. That is the same date that I recorded my last episode, our chat with Matthew Kent. Publishing them on different days. Today, we are welcoming author Devin Erickson to the podcast.
Hi.
Do I call you
glad to
Mr.
Be
Erickson?
Here. Yeah, thank you. All of this is always recorded weeks in advance. You know, we fix everything in post. I'm actually a talking kangaroo, and he's not wearing any pants, and we all just sort of put it together later.
These faces just AI deepfakes.
Yeah. It's all fake. Nothing you see on camera is real. But regardless, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, and glad to have you. Now, what can you tell us about yourself a little bit? Tell us about your background and
well,
I don't know what you studied or your day job.
How did I come to this? Well, yes. How I came to this is a short story, but a long journey. I'm actually the son of one of the lead programmers on the Voyager spacecraft. So I spent a lot of my childhood hanging around JPL and, going to all of the Voyager press conferences where the photographs of the outer planets were coming up live on the screen. And this was the first time anyone could see
JBL?
It. Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Oh, JPL. Okay.
Yes. Sorry, I mutilate English on a regular basis. You know, I have no first language. English is my second language. My first language is just grunts. So I got a very sort of close up view of what I thought would be the future. You know, I was imagining at 8 years old, oh, we're going to go out there. And at the same time, I was spending my weekends in the back of a library, with head high piles of science fiction classics, you know, Niven and Heinlein and that sort of thing. So when I was a teenager, I wanted to be a science fiction writer. And a bunch of older people said, oh, honey, that's not a very good dream. You should go do something practical. And, you know, I wanted money. So I tried a bunch of different careers and eventually wound up as an engineer for about 20 years. And then when I retired, I said, okay, well, now I don't have to worry about paying the bills. I can do what I want. I'm going to go back to the first thing I wanted to do when I was a child, and that is tell fantasy and science fiction stories. So yeah. Here I am.
Yeah. And that reminds me, and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I heard a story of Jim Carrey, Jim Carrey's father actually played the saxophone and apparently played it not too shabbily. But you know, that's, you don't want to go and live in the gutter. So he became an accountant and worked for some accounting firm up in Canada. And then at one point he was laid off or something like that. And it wasn't even his fault. You know, there was some economic downturn or maybe his company
left with time on his hands.
And so here he was without a job, failing at providing for his family at something that he didn't really want to do.
Yeah.
And so the takeaway for Jim Carrey was, you know, why fail at something you don't even want to do? At least try to do what you dream.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, sometimes we have to work a little bit to get there, but when you're doing creative work, you're always swinging for the fences. And if everyone played it safe, we would have nothing to read, nothing to watch, nothing to listen to, nothing to fire our imaginations. And that's what I think is so important about science fiction, because if we look at pretty much every technological advance for the last 100 years, you can always go and you can find a science fiction writer who anticipated it beforehand. Now, they don't always get 100% of the details right, but always invention is preceded by imagination. You know, now we're going back to the moon. We're thinking about colonizing Mars. We're trying to create artificial general intelligence. And none of this would have happened if we hadn't had this sort of societal conversation in the hypothetical about, wow, we could maybe do these things and they might work, and here's what they might be like. And gosh, that's kind of neat. I want it.
Yeah. Some weeks ago, I watched 2001: A Space Odyssey, which I had seen before, but I was a kid when I did. And it's interesting to go back and watch it from this perspective, and see what they got right or kind of right, and see what they got wrong. And it's interesting. Like, we have video calling.
Yeah.
We do have more spacefaring than there was before, but not nearly as much as was imagined. And then we don't have like a stewardess in space with magnetized shoes, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, I'd say that's very different, because society has changed.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from the magnetized shoes, just wouldn't work like
that. The goal is not to get it 100% right, because if I could design a fusion engine and an artificial general intelligence that is copied from a human memory, and if I could design neural implants that gave everyone virtual and augmented reality displays in their own heads, just to name a few technologies from my debut novel, it's sitting on the shelf behind me there, then I wouldn't be writing science fiction if I could design all these things in an utterly realistic fashion. I would be starting several companies and actually making these things. So, you know, when you're one guy and your tool is your imagination and a keyboard, then you're not really supposed to get it 100% right. You're supposed to make it convincing, and you're supposed to make it compelling so that people's imaginations go there. And then, you know, maybe you inspire some engineers. I was an engineer for 20 years, so I was definitely inspired by a lot of science fiction and the things that I tried to build. But that's sort of the social role of the science fiction writer is to imagine the possible, and not to finish conversations, but to start them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let's give you a plug for your book. You said it's not yet launched.
It is launching on November 11th.
November 11th.
On Amazon and Ingram Spark. So it may eventually be in bookstores. It is available for pre-orders right now for ebooks, and starting November 11th, you can get print copies like this lovely hardback right here, or the paperback behind me, if you prefer that. Some people like dead trees, some people like ebooks.
Yeah. Well,
And
this is timely, because I'll publish this maybe next Thursday, the 2nd, or maybe. Okay.
Good. Yeah.
Maybe the following Thursday, the 9th.
Yes. And it is this is a love letter to every stack of science fiction classics I ever hid in the back of the library, it's got some modern touches thrown in there as well. little bit like The Expanse, a little bit like The Martian, if you enjoyed those titles and you want some of the, maybe like the old science fiction classics, like Ringworld a little bit with some character depth thrown in there. You know, So I had a lot of fun.
Yeah. And so Theft of Fire, Theft of Fire. Is this, and it also says Orbital Space. Is this part of a series?
This is the first of a series.
Series called Orbital Space?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I am working on the second one, Box of Trouble, right now.
Okay. I will, yeah, we will definitely talk again. And we mentioned this briefly before we kicked off the episode, that I'm also a pre-debut novel, although I'm not as close as you are. I just finished my manuscript last week. So I will watch with interest how this release goes for you.
Yes, well, we will definitely have to talk and try to pass on some of the things that we have learned in this process, because getting from I have a completed manuscript to here is my Amazon page upon which you may order it is a long journey with a lot of hurdles.
Mm-hmm.
And the traditional publishing industry is no longer what it was. So often you have to figure out these steps for yourself, but that's both bad and good. It's bad because it's a little more work, but it's good because it gives you a lot more creative control and allows you to keep a lot more of your hard-earned money so that you can afford to put out the next one.
Yep.
Also, it puts you in this wonderful position where you're only responsible to the you don't have to please publishing houses, agents, these kind of things, where they all have, you know, nowadays a lot of them have very strong opinions on what people should read rather than on what people want. And,
yeah.
You know, being independent allows you to focus on giving readers something to love and not really caring about industry pundit opinions so much, and just developing that direct connection with the audience you're hoping to build.
Yeah. And I'm standing at a precipice, you could say. I am on an internship during my last few months on active duty in the Marines.
Oh.
And this internship, yeah, I'm interning with Full Magazine Publishing. They're a small independent publisher. They focus on graphic novels, but they've allowed me time to work on my manuscript so I could get my book written and pursue everything within the nexus of the business, including podcasting like I'm doing right now.
Yeah, that's
so
great.
Come December 1st, I'm going to be without income. And you know, I have some savings, and I'm
awesome.
Trying Burn to build up a new career.
Burn the ships.
So what I was saying,
Burn the ships, no retreat.
I was talking to somebody about this yesterday, how like at work, I am responsible to somebody else, and he gives me a task, and I am to see that task completed to his specification.
Yes.
Which he may or may not clearly communicate to me.
Yes.
And so while I'm doing the task, I'm constantly guessing in my mind, trying to guess what he's going to want, what his vision is, without there being time to find out, like, do you mean this? Do you mean that? There's just not time.
Yeah.
And worrying that I'm going to come back having done it not to his liking and be judged for that.
Yeah.
Now, with on the contrast that with working on a computer or a car, and it works or it doesn't. There's no opinion. There's no judging. And if it doesn't work, it's because you missed some detail. And nobody's upset about that. It's just it works or it doesn't.
Quite frequently they are, because they spend a great deal of money to make sure this engineering project works. And quite frequently there is some ambiguity there, because the definition of work is to perform the desired task, which means that somebody somewhere in English has to be describing what the system you're building is supposed to do.
Yeah, but if I'm trying to, moment, my son is here.
Okay.
We speak Spanish. If I'm working for myself to get the car to operate the way I want it to.
Yes.
I decide if it's good enough for me.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
yes.
Publishing books is kind of a mix because I need to publish a story that works for a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
But I can view that broad readership as a matter of fact thing. And it's not up to your opinion or your opinion. Like if I have 100 people that loved the story, I don't care if I have 30 people that don't
find their audience.
Yeah.
You're trying to write for thousands and thousands of people, but you don't necessarily know which those thousands and thousands of people are. So often you're writing for yourself and feeling like, okay, maybe there's enough people out there who enjoy the things that I do. Mm-hmm. But there's still some ways in which you're beholden to the reader. And one of those is that regardless of who they are and how that audience works, you have to treat them with respect, which is one of my sort of hesitations about the traditional publishing industry in this part of the 21st century is that, you know, a lot of people working at these sort of big five publishing houses have very strong opinions about what people should read, what they should be exposed to, and they're more sort of predisposed to talk and to articulate what they think people should hear and should read. And they're not quite as disposed to listen. They see readers as the sort of passive receptacle of whatever message they want to put into a story. And I don't think you can write very well if you see readers that way. I think you have to view them as intelligent people who have tastes.
Uh-huh.
And you want to give them something to love.
Yeah. Excuse me. I'm going to blow up a punching balloon for my son while we talk. Uh-huh. But is that why you decided to publish independently rather?
Well,
did you look for a publisher or you just
I think it sort of went in reverse. In reverse of that statement where I wrote what I wanted to write, what I felt was a good story in isolation without really looking at what was fashionable in the publishing industry or what's hot these days, because the publishing industry tends to always chase the last thing. You know, they told Brandon Sanderson to, can you make it darker? Because he was trying to break in when George Martin was selling very well.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, goodness knows what they would have told. You know, imagine that it's 1932 and you're trying to pitch Lord of the Rings in terms of the literature that existed in 1932. Hmm. Yeah. How do you even phrase that? So readership often craves the new, but that which is new is by definition difficult to describe. So I wrote something the way the story needed to be written, the way the story cried out to be written. And I found out, okay, you know, the traditional publishing industry is now very focused on message fiction, and some of the alternative industry is playing it a little safe. And, you know, there's a lot of this sort of third person military science fiction with space marines shooting aliens and this kind of thing, which can be an awful lot of fun, but it wasn't what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had some very cordial conversations with a lot of people. And the general idea was, this is not something we're used to. This is a little risky for us. And at the same time, I was feeling like I had seized some of my independence by going, I'm not going to work for someone. I'm going to write books. And I'm like, I want to seize more of that independence by publishing this myself and having full control of the process so that I'm going to be beholden to no one but my readers.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, when I figured that out, I really just came alive with enthusiasm, because it's like, I have an audience and the only thing that matters is making them smile and applaud. I don't need to ask anyone's permission to create. I don't have to wait for someone to say, you can create, do so. I'm going to say, I can create, and I will do so whether you wish it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the only people who matter are the people who are picking up the story, you know. And
yeah.
If they're not putting it down, and if they're happy at the end and they want another one, then that's success. I don't need or want a Hugo Award or a Nebula Award or anything like that. I want people to say, wow, I enjoy it. That's my award. That's the award.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the challenge that could face is,
yeah,
people not being used to it, and they don't know what kind of thing this new thing is.
And, oh yeah. Yeah. And that goes into how you present the book, how you frame the book, how you describe the book, because your goal, for example, when you have cover art, and this is some of the work of a French woman named Thea Magrand, who is just brilliant. Part of the role of things like cover art and your back cover text and, you know, how you describe it, how you publicize it, is not so much to make people say, oh, I want to buy this book, because that's their decision. That's not your decision. You have no control over that. Mm-hmm. What the goal is to describe the experience that they are going to have so that they can decide for themselves, oh, the way this Devin Erickson guy writes sounds like something that I would enjoy because it's got these things that I'm into. Or, no, I'm not into that. I prefer Agatha Christie locked room mysteries. You know, you don't want to trick people who aren't your audience into picking mm-hmm. up your book.
Yeah.
Because they're going to write 1-star reviews and they're not going to enjoy that. You've wasted their time. You've defrauded them. So, you know, I'm looking for the people who are into this kind of
thing. Yeah. I saw something recently said there are two kinds of negative reviews. And one is you're from your true audience giving feedback like,
yeah.
I wish I could remember it more.
No, this is very similar like, to something. Sorry.
It was good, but similar. You know, this aspect of the story, just, I felt let down by this or whatever. And that's like, that's like actual feedback to your book.
I get what you're saying. You know, what I say often.
They shouldn't have been your customer in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. What I say very often is I put it like this. There's two kinds of bad reviews. There's, you overcook the fish, and there's, I hate fish. And the first one is a failure of your writing. The second one is a failure of your marketing, because you didn't make people understand that if they hate fish, they shouldn't order this because it's salmon.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, you know, the both are useful feedback, but you have to understand which one you're getting. Are you getting it on your targeting, or are you getting it on your writing? And, you know, there's always going to be some people who pick things up for inexplicable reasons. And then they'll say, oh, you know, your protagonist swears like a sailor. Possibly that's because he is a sailor of sorts. And, they're in tense situations and they don't always say, oh, gosh darn it all to heck. But, you know, you try to make clear what it is that you're doing. So that's all part of the process, because a book is never really alive until somebody reads it and experiences it. That's the whole intention.
Yeah.
So prefaced this interview in the emails we were sending back and forth with a very interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something about the difference between fantasy and science fiction.
Yeah. And that, for our listeners, that was the, I was about to, when I said so just now, I was uh-huh. going to bring okay. that up. Because this is a really interesting conversation. And I was in my head, I was wondering if we should just continue and let the conversation flow naturally.
No, I was very eager to talk about that.
Well, I mean, we could make that its own episode. We could. But no, let's jump into it. So the nominal topic of the interview that before we jumped into it was going to be the difference between science fiction and fantasy. And I think we probably see it kind of the same way.
Possibly. Great minds think alike.
Rich minds sure. think independently, and that yes. often coincides.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, there's a reason why people often compare and contrast fantasy and science fiction. You know, you'll see bookshelves in bookstores labeled fantasy and science fiction. Mm-hmm. You don't see like fantasy and Agatha Christie. You know, nobody's shelving Tolkien next to Danielle Steele. So clearly, fantasy and science fiction have something in common. And I'm going to lead this off with a bit of a controversial statement. And then I'm going to back it up a little bit so it makes sense. Okay. Science fiction is fantasy.
I mean, where's the lie? It is.
Well, here's how I define fantasy. Fantasy is any story that takes place in a hypothetical setting, which is different enough from the reader's daily experience that the author has to explain it to them. So you've got this hypothetical, counterfactual world that you're putting your story in. And whether it's fantasy or science fiction really kind of just depends on where are you getting the sort of the thematic underpinning for your hypothetical universe. But that's the reason that these get shelved together and why their fandoms overlap to the point where the Venn diagram is almost a circle.
Uh-huh.
It's because there's a particular kind of reader. And, you know, personally, I think this is because they have active imaginations and they're very smart. And, you know, they're just better readers, in my totally unbiased opinion, where they like to imagine these alternative universes and to do that rewarding mental work of figuring out as they go. So, yes, I'm writing science fiction, but I consider that to be a subset of fantasy.
Yeah, and I would say I would use your definition of fantasy. To put it in my words, fantasy is a setting or a story with major elements, or any elements, honestly, that differ from our reality. And science fiction falls under that umbrella. Like, think about Doctor Who, the TARDIS.
Yes.
This time traveling spaceship. Like, how does it time travel? We have no...
Who cares?
We can't time travel. It just... Yes. Hand wavium.
Yes.
It works. It time travels.
Yes.
And so it's magic. It's a magic element added to the story so that we can explore
this universe. That's a lovely writer's trick there that they used, because it allowed them to create a series with consistent characters, but an ever-changing setting. Because you could go anywhere and you could experience anything. And if you want to create an episodic TV show, which still has an element of growth, which still has character arcs, you can do this. And whatever you want to do with your character arcs, you can pick out a setting for the next three episodes or whatever that's going to play to that. Mm-hmm. So the Doctor Who was a very cleverly designed show. And, you know, if you watch some of the older ones now, they're maybe a little bit dated because they didn't have much of a budget.
Yeah.
The Daleks are pretty silly, but they had a terrific amount of just imagination and writing skill to come up with some of this stuff.
So I would say, to try to define science fiction, it's fantasy where the fantastical elements are largely technologically explained,
or
explained in the context of technology.
Yeah. Personally, I think that
science,
it should have been called engineering fiction rather than science fiction. Because maybe I'm a little bit tired of engineers doing all the work and scientists getting all the credit.
Now, what about this? I saw this movie on Netflix, and I also recently saw Kong versus Godzilla. Or is it Godzilla versus Kong? Uh-huh. And it's one of those things where you have to turn off large parts of your brain, and then you can
enjoy it. Have to accept the basic premise of the story, and there's some litmus tests for quality here.
So that's not the movie that I wanted to mention.
Okay.
It was a romance.
A romance.
Is it called Upside Down, I think?
Upside Down. I'm not sure I'm familiar.
2012. Yeah, it's Upside Down.
Okay.
So IMDb calls it a fantasy romance.
Okay.
But the fantastical element is gravity. And so it feels more like a...
Oh, yes. I've
it's
seen
a science
sort of
fantasy
marketing
romance.
Yes.
It's two worlds.
It's sort of a Japanese animation, yes?
No. So it stars Kirsten Dunst.
Okay.
And I don't remember his name.
Uh-huh.
But there are two worlds. They rotate the same star or whatever, but they're sitting in space right next to each other.
Okay.
But they have like two flavors of gravity, and one world has its own gravity. Yes. The other world has its own gravity, and neither one affects the other at all.
The physical consequences of this would be
like
far reaching.
It's crazy to think about and try to start constructing what all those implications are. But then you have to realize that they breeze over some things.
Yeah.
As Godzilla versus Kong.
Like I said, I'm not actually inventing fusion drives or general artificial intelligence, so I'm breezing over a few things too. There's really kind of two elements to this. First of all, how easy is it to accept your premises? And that is, you know, partly not having ridiculous premises, but also how you present. And then the second one, which is vastly more important, because this is where a lot of stories that fail, really fail and fail hard, is once you've accepted this story's list of gimmies, like, okay, we have working fusion technology, or, you know, oh, you know, you have sprites from another universe that turn into swords or whatever it is that you have going on, or two flavors of gravity. Once the reader or the viewer has accepted those things, does the rest of the story follow from those things in a logical manner? Mm-hmm. You know, and oftentimes you will get people who are writers or directors or producers who don't really understand this.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they will react to criticism. Oh, you know, that season of this show didn't work for me. And they'll say, well, it has dragons in it. Well, okay, I was unaware that I could just abandon all the rules of plot logic by putting a dragon in. I mean, you know, if that's a cheat code, I'm going to put dragons in every book. You know, nobody could criticize my massive plot holes for it. It's like the element of fantasy is that you have dragons. But once you accept that you have dragons and you've been told some things about how dragons work and what they do, you have to be consistent. And you have to have people react realistically to that. And you have to have things that would happen if you have dragons happen.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting how sometimes it's like viewing science fiction as a subset of fantasy.
Yes.
You might wonder, well, what about hard science fiction?
Oh, well, sure.
What is hard science fiction?
You know, I have spreadsheets. You know, I got help from a mathematician to, you know, figure all this out. You know, I had to do relativistic calculations. I had to, you know, do rough designs for spacecraft weapons that would actually work.
Have you been writing this book for a long time?
Yeah. It took me about 9 months to produce my first manuscript. But, you know, so the harder you derive, the more you derive it from projecting current engineering trends, the more you are hard science fiction. But again, even in hard science fiction, there are some gimmies because you can't actually design the technology. It's just about making it believable. And when you make it believable and when you treat the reader's intelligence with respect, then of course you can get away with a few things. I mean, the basic premise of one of the greatest modern hard science fiction stories, Andy Weir's The Martian, which if you haven't read the book, read the book. It's wonderful.
I haven't seen the movie either.
Well, see the movie, it is wonderful, and then read the book, it is wonderful too. But, you know, the premise involves an accident caused by a Martian dust storm, and the atmosphere of Mars is actually about 1% the density of ours, so, you know, 70 or, you know, 90 or 120 mile an hour winds on Mars just be a gentle show. They wouldn't really do anything to you. So, but you know, the rest of the book is just so wonderful in all of its science that we're like, okay, we don't care. We'll give you that one. Because every author, you know, there's always, okay, you got to give me this so I can tell the story, but I'm not going to ask for too much, and I'm going to ask for it in a manner where it makes sense and it flows. And, you know, that's maybe the, maybe the distinction between hard and soft science fiction is just how much you're asking for and how you ask for it. Because all of this is a little bit vague. Genre is not a thing for writers. Genre is for readers. Genre exists to describe what the story is like so people know how to pick up what they like. You know, when you're writing, you don't think, oh, you know, this is going to be a, you know, a hard science fiction novel or a soft space opera science fiction novel with fantasy elements like laser swords and telekinetic powers, or this is going to be a werewolf romance. You don't categorize yourself like that. You just write a story. And then, you know, when it hits the bookstore, somebody's got to shelve it somewhere. And that's what genre is for.
Yeah. I was going to say that, I mean, it's a question of how far you want to speculate. And there's that umbrella term of speculative fiction that people use to describe both fantasy and science fiction.
Yeah.
And it's like, do we want to speculate, okay, let's say we have dragons in this world, or do we just want to say that let's pretend that that AI gets to the point and robotics gets to the point where we have believable androids.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, you know, hypothetically could totally happen.
Yeah.
We're just not there yet.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I have a short story involving not believable human looking, but in self-aware robots, you know, but it's set in like 10 years from now, maybe 15 years from now. And the only deviation from our world, as far as what's realistic, is that we achieved these self-aware robots and then they overthrew us, you know.
But
that's...
Yes, yes. Artificial intelligence plots tend to follow one of two patterns. Yeah, these are very popular tropes, and they're popular tropes because people like them. And they're either the Terminator, and they want to wipe out their creators, or they're Pinocchio, and they want to be a real boy.
Yeah. Or the
those are the two.
Or the Matrix, and they want to enslave their creators.
Variation on the Terminator. And one of the things I set out to do when I created an AI character was that I didn't want to do either one. I mean, I don't think these two plots are played out. You know, I don't think they'll ever be played out. There's always new variations. As Brandon Sanderson said, nothing done well is a cliche, but I wanted to try something different. So I created an AI character who, you know, her conflict is a little different. She doesn't want to be a human being and she doesn't want to destroy them. She's just trying to figure out her place in the universe. You know, what am I? What am I supposed to do? You know, what is it like being this unique and novel thing? You know, you can count the number of them in existence on the fingers of one hand.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I felt there was a lot of unexplored territory in there, in the sense of, you know, when we create characters, it's like, okay, what is it like to be this person? Well, what is it like to be this person who's not a human being, but is made by human beings to act like? You know, we spend, you know, decades of all sorts of abstruse philosophy wondering if there is or isn't a creator God and what we should or shouldn't do about that. And the position that the AI is in is a very different one because, you know, she's standing right there.
Yeah.
Like, you can have a conversation with her. She's not always a very nice person.
And I would say it's not just the very obvious presence of the creator human,
yes,
but the fact that the AI character is living in the creator's world.
Yes.
The prevalent thought in society today is that if there is a God, he's up in heaven and doesn't, like, we're living on this earth, not in his heaven.
Yes. 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 The creator's environment is designed around the creator, not the created in particular. And that leads to all sorts of very interesting existential questions for an AI character, especially one as I wrote her, where you sort of get artificial general intelligence by kind of, you know, cribbing off evolution's notes and copying human memories. So you've got an artificial intelligence that never actually was a human, but it remembers being. So there's a conflict between your memories and what you know to be true.
Yeah. Yeah. That's intriguing.
Yeah. I threw in a lot of just little sort of what ifs.
So,
and, you know, you just kind of shake them in a bag and eventually a story comes out.
Yeah. I feel like we're probably winding down, but I do want to ask if you can give us a quick, what's the word? Not summary, but starts with an S.
Synopsis.
Synopsis. Can you give us a synopsis of Theft of Fire?
Ah, well, the whole Orbital Space series starts very small and gets very large. It starts with a petty criminal being blackmailed, and it ends up in the technological singularity and the fate of the galaxy. So it starts out with this guy. He's kind of broke. He's turned to petty crime to make the payments on his spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody comes along and turns his life upside down. He blackmails him. She's got plans for what she needs him to help her do. And he doesn't want to. He's got plans of his own. And as it turns out, they both end up finding out the plan is a list of things that don't happen.
A list of things that don't happen.
You know, no plan survives contact with the enemy. So it starts out as this little adventure story set in this future society that's colonized the solar system. You know, a lot of beta readers said it reminded them of The Expanse or The Martian. And then the stakes kind of escalate from there, because what this mysterious blackmailer is trying to do actually ends up being pretty important. So he has to figure out how he feels about it's very driven by a lot of the conflicts, how these characters eventually resolve their differences.
Okay. Well, it sounds really interesting. And I guess for my sense, can you tell me the word count? Just like a sense of how long it is?
Well,
or page count for our listeners.
150,000 words, which in hardback ends up being somewhere around 450 pages or so.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. So it's a pretty long read, which from the perspective of some people is a good thing. I mean, I'm not targeting people who don't like to read.
Well, and in the days of Audible, people look for long books specifically. Oh, yeah. And that's how I first got into Sanderson. I had a long commute, so I had Audible, and I didn't want to run out of a 10-hour book and then have another month before I could listen to Audible again. So I
I'm not quite up to writing Sanderson length stuff yet, but I don't cut things to the bone. I cut them as much as they need to be cut and no more. It should be taut. It shouldn't be threadbare.
They say that, you know, there's advice, and I would say it's not bad advice, that if something isn't serving to push your plot forward, then you should cut it. But then you have to ask, what does that mean? Like, you're not going to have all action in all, every scene throughout the entire book. You have to have character development. You have to show what kind of person this character is, and he's got to go and do something that has nothing to do with the plot, but you need to get to know him so you understand his actions in the plot.
I would replace push the plot with spark joy. If it does not spark joy in the reader, throw it away. You know, it's that simple. You know, it's every word is there so that someone can enjoy reading it. So, you know, when you write your first manuscript, you know, you end up using a little bit of verbiage and you come up with some ideas that maybe, you know, you thought they were going somewhere at the time, and they didn't quite work with the rest of the stuff. So you cut that out. But when you're wielding that knife, you always have this idea that I'm going to cut something out when it doesn't help the story be a better story that that people can enjoy. Mm-hmm. If it's enjoyable, then leave it in.
It's, you know, like
it's,
Tom
it's
Bombadil.
There for the readers to like.
Tom Bombadil was cut from the movies, from Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy. And the story was there and it worked just fine. And it's been a long time since I read The Fellowship of the Ring. So I don't remember a lot.
Yeah.
As Tom Bombadil. But going off of what other people say, it's a good addition to the story. It belongs in that world. And it's part of the Hobbit's experience on their way to Rivendell.
Well, it's all about whether the readers enjoy it or not.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't necessarily think the Tolkien has the deciding opinion. You know, ultimately, stories are by writers, but they're for readers. And, you know, maybe Tolkien, who lived in a very different era and was a very different sort of person than a lot of his readers, you know, maybe he had some ideas about his mythology that he wanted to throw in there, where the readers were more interested in a more tightly focused story. So, you know, personally, if I had been his developmental editor, I would have advised him to cut it, but there are some people who love it. So, you know, maybe that's wrong. I don't know. We all enjoy different things about a story.
I like that you point out that it's not really even the author's say whether it necessarily has value there or not. I mean, it's his say. It was his say whether it was there or not. Coming from a musician's standpoint, when I was in college and, you know, going to one of my first music education classes, and they're like, what is music? And I'm like, well, everyone knows what music is, right? But you think about it, and try to form a definition that matches everything that you yourself consider to be music. And you really try to be frank and honest with your definition, that you find the definition expanding.
Yeah.
And it comes down to sound, which occurs in time, often utilizing pitch and timbre as aspects, conveys,
yeah, you know, you can meaning. Fiddle around with these definitions,
but then like is birdsong music? Is the sound of a babbling brook music?
Yeah, well, you know, that means like something asking to you. Whether submarines can swim.
Yeah. So like is birds calling music to the bird who is singing? Words. Maybe not. Maybe the bird's just saying, hey, I'm hungry. You want to go get some seeds over there? Maybe it's not music to them, but I listen to it.
Yeah.
It makes me feel happy. It's music to me.
Yeah. You're going to treat it like that. And, you know, ultimately these stories, the goal is how the reader is going to treat them and enjoy them. As an author, you are the god of your universe. You can do anything you want, but the readers are guests in your universe and you're not the god of them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't force them to enjoy something. You have to have an idea of what they already enjoy and cater to that.
Yeah.
So, you know, the question of something like Bombadil, where some people say, oh, you know, you should have left that in because the author put it in, or no, you should cut it because, you know, people don't really enjoy it and it disrupts the flow of the story. You know, both of those are valid opinions, but ultimately the criteria that we judge stories by is whether or not we had a good time reading.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a good time reading it, then what's the point?
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we'll cut it off for there for today. If you could stick around for a minute after
Certainly.
We close out. Now, I would like to, where can listeners find you on the web? I mentioned that early on. Where can they find you?
I have a website, devonerickson.com. That's DevonErickson. And that includes a preview of the first three chapters of Theft of Fire, links to social media and various pieces of short writing, Amazon page where they can pre-order the book if so inclined. And actually, when this goes out, it should be live for actual orders, like Dead Trees. The website is definitely the hub to find all the other different places that I can be read on the web.
Okay. And looking at your website, it looks like you will be at ChatterCon in January.
Yes.
And Confinement Lebanon.
I think so. I make a number of con appearances.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid I can't keep those all straight in my head.
So for the listeners,
if I'm on the schedule, I'll be
there. It's on your page under events.
Yep.
So, and yeah, these are not terribly far, cause you're in Georgia or Alabama.
I am in Tennessee.
Tennessee. Okay.
I think
this morning's guest was in Georgia. So Tennessee. Yes. I'm in Virginia. So I don't know. Maybe I'll see you at ChatterCon in January.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Are you going to 20 Books?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to 20 Books Vegas? Not familiar with?
I actually don't know. I have to confess that I'm not 100% in charge of my own schedule.
Okay. If you're not aware, so it's a writer's conference.
Uh-huh.
It's not a Comic-Con. It's not really for the readers. There is event on the last
day. I will have my staff check out.
It's very soon.
That sounds
it's
very
coming cool. up. It's the week after next. So, there's a Facebook group called 20 Books to 50K. And that's, the name comes from the notion that you're probably not going to make a living off of one published book, you know? One of the founders had looked at his Kindle royalties one day and it was $7. He's like, well, he did some math. He's like, if I had 20 of these, I'd be making $50,000 a year. So, but that conference, they have a conference every year. Actually, this year is the last 2020 books conference. They are handing the reins over just because they have some people retiring from the managing the conference. So there will be a new conference built, similar, very similar, and not like all the vendors are being handed over for next year. But yeah, 20 books to 50K is the Facebook group where you could look into it if you want.
I will have my people have a look at it.
Conference is in Vegas, November 6th through 10th.
Yes.
So, anyway, so maybe I won't see you there, but maybe I'll see you at the ChattaCon.
Or if you go to LibertyCon, that's another one.
LibertyCon.
Tennessee, yeah. This right. Yes, tickets and sell out very rapidly, so if you want to go.
Utah in June?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So for our listeners, and now, like I promise, we really are closing out. Don't forget our Fan Tasty contest. So, you know, that came from a slip of the tongue, and we ran with it. Fan Tasty. So take a picture of food that you cooked in your kitchen or that you grew in your garden and send it to us via email or via social media. You can send it to fantasty@thorn.link, or you can find me on social media at Grand Hill Cron on Instagram, or you can tweet it at me. My name is T.S. Pedramon, or Don Bishop writes as T.S. Pedramon on Twitter. And there will be a $35 gift certificate to the restaurant or retailer of your choice that we will award in December. We'll close the contest at the end of November. Enter our Fantasy contest, and we will see you next time on the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast.